1 Corinthians 2:1 through 2:5, the sixth talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on April 14, 2002, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2002. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're back in 1 Corinthians, starting in chapter 2 today. If you've been with us, you recall that Paul has been dealing with the concept of the wisdom of the gospel versus the wisdom of the world. And the reason he's been doing that is because he seems to have been charged by a number of the Corinthians with being inadequate as a teacher and a speaker. They're not interested in him. They're somewhat embarrassed by him because he lacks this quality that they would call wisdom. In chapter 2, Paul now is going to turn directly to the issue of how he speaks. He's been talking in general about the wisdom of the world and why God has not been interested in making the gospel palatable to those who value the wisdom of the world. Now he turns directly to talk about the way he talked when he was with them before. So in chapter 2, he says, "And when I came to you, brethren, I did not come preaching the testimony of God to you with preeminence of speech or of wisdom. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my word and my preaching were not in the persuasiveness of wisdom, but in proof of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." So, Paul here, he's talking about when he came to them. He's talking about that year and a half that he lived among the Corinthians and taught them. That's, after all, where they got the impression that they have of him. When they're thinking about what kind of a teacher Paul is, they're thinking about what they remember him doing while he was there for that year and a half. So he says, "When I came to you, brethren, I did not come preaching the testimony of God to you with preeminence of speech or of wisdom." What is it that the Corinthians want of Paul, at least some of them? I want to remind you what I've been saying here. By this preeminence of speech or wisdom, it's not just flowery speech. It's not just that they want him to say what he has to say with a little more style and panache or something like that. They want him to speak what they would consider to be wise. They want him to win the admiration of the powerful and the important by the power of his argument and the attractiveness of his message. They don't want to be embarrassed by him. They want him to be saying stuff that the world around them will say, "Now, yeah, Paul, now there's a man. There's a wise person." They admire the kind of speaker who can devastate an opponent and win the crowd over to their side. There's, in Greek culture in particular, there was a certain value set on this sort of thing, and they admired people who could win the crowd and gain the admiration of the crowd in that way and devastate the opposition while they're doing it. Paul says, "It was not my purpose to seek preeminence in speech and wisdom." Now, by this time I hope we're clear about this, but Paul is not saying that his message is not wise. He's not saying, "I did not care whether what I said was wise or not." That's not what he's getting at. He sees the gospel as profound wisdom. But what he's saying is it was never his goal to be judged as preeminent as a speaker. He was not interested in entering into the culture in the way that the Corinthians want him to and competing on those terms. It's not that Paul tried and failed, it's that he had no interest in doing it. He did not set out to win the approval of the crowd by the attractiveness of his message from a worldly perspective. as he has already argued, the world by nature thinks that the gospel is foolish. By nature, we are interested in other things. And you can't take people who are interested in other things and make them think that you are wise and profound by preaching the gospel. If you preach the gospel, they're going to find it uninteresting. And if you make it interesting, then you're not preaching the gospel anymore. That's what he's been saying. So here he's saying, as you think back on what I did when I was there, stop judging me for failing to do what I never tried to do anyway. It was not my goal. I know that I didn't come across as wise from the perspective of the movers and shakers in Corinth. You're not telling me anything I don't know. But I never set out to do it in the first place. It was not my goal. What did I set out to do? He says, "For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." Now, we need to talk about this verse for a minute, because I think people end up taking this verse in a lot of ways that are not necessarily what Paul's getting at. I know I say that sort of thing a lot. You're all thinking, when is the last time that Ron got up and said, "You know what everybody says about this passage? That's what it says." "You know what you've always heard this passage means?" "Yeah, that's it." I know. But the thing is that there is this crossroads that we come to. We have to make this decision. Am I just going to take this verse, look at it and say, "Well, it kind of sounds like it's saying that," and run with it? Or am I actually going to pay attention to the whole argument, look at what Paul's saying, and say, "Well, no, he can't have meant that. I think he has to mean this, given everything else that he's talking about." That's what I'm saying we need to do. It is true that I believe that the Christian culture around us in general, certainly the part of Christianity that I came up in, that I came up through the ranks in, did not emphasize the idea that I need to pay attention to the context of the argument and make sure I'm understanding what it is that the author's getting at. I just was not taught to do that. And because we're not being taught to do that, we tend to come to verses like this and just run with them. So what people oftentimes do with this is they say, "Okay, well, see, here's Paul saying that he deliberately chose not to talk about any complicated theology or philosophical issues or anything like that. He didn't want to get into anything that was going to be divisive or controversial or hard to think about. He just went around saying, 'Jesus Christ and Him crucified,' over and over again. And if people tried to ask him, you know, philosophical questions or, you know, 'Why do you say what you're saying?' or 'What about this passage in the Old Testament?' He just said, 'No, I don't want to deal with that kind of stuff. I'm just going to preach the gospel. Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Don't bother me with all of that theology stuff.'" Sometimes people draw the conclusion, they look at, you may remember Jack talking about this when we were in Acts. Paul, before he went to Corinth, he went to Athens. And there's the very famous scene, Mars Hill, where he gets up and he gives a talk. This is not a Jewish crowd. This is not a crowd that has much familiarity with the scriptures. These are people who are interested in the Greek poets and philosophers. And he quotes several of those poets, and he makes this case that the unknown God that they have a statue to is in fact the creator God, Yahweh, who is going to judge mankind through the man, Jesus Christ, that he raised from the dead. And people sometimes argue, "Well, we can see what happened here. Paul tried this philosophical stuff in Athens, and it didn't work. So when he got to Corinth, he decided, 'I'm not going to talk about any of that stuff. I'm just going to talk about Jesus Christ and Him crucified.'" I think that's a very unlikely way of putting the picture together. That's not what Paul is getting at, and it's important for us to understand this, I think. Because if we're going to use this as a model, if we're going to follow Paul here and somehow this is a good thing to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified, we want to make sure that we know what it is He did and what it is we're emulating. So I think that picture that somehow he's saying, you know, let's not talk about theology or philosophy, I'm just going to keep saying over and over again that Jesus Christ and Him crucified and you guys can figure it out. That's very unlikely. First of all, we know when we look in Acts that how Paul conducted himself when he was there, that he in fact is described as going to the synagogue, reasoning with the Jews, demonstrating things from the Old Testament. I mean, the fact is that we know that he entered into theological and exegetical discussions in defending the idea that Jesus was the Christ. He didn't just say, I just say Jesus is the Christ. Well, I don't have to give you any reason, I just say so. I mean, he went to the Old Testament, he argued with them, they said, well, what about this? And he said, no, you're not getting the point, it means this instead. I mean, that's the sort of thing that he did. So when he describes whatever it is he did, when he said, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified, he doesn't mean that he didn't think about it or give reasonable arguments or anything like that. Because we know that that's not what he did. Next, we have to see in this context, what is he contrasting this with? What he's saying is, I did not seek to be preeminent in wisdom and speech. Instead, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. The contrast that he's making here is between seeking somehow to win the crowd through this preeminence in speech and wisdom versus just playing it straight, just preaching the gospel. He has already said that the gospel and worldly wisdom are incompatible. He knows that he can't pretty the gospel up enough to make the world find it attractive. So what he's saying here basically is, I chose not to adulterate the gospel. I did not seek to give people the attractive worldly kind of message that they would think was wise. Instead, I determined to stick with the gospel. I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. What is he excluding? Is he excluding discussions about what passages mean? Is he excluding discussions about theology? Is he excluding discussions like he had in Athens about the unknown God and what Greek philosophers say, if somebody wanted to talk to him about that? I'd say no, he's not excluding any of that. What he's excluding is the idea that somehow he's going to put on this facade of wisdom in order to win people. He's saying, no, I just stuck to the real story, which is Jesus Christ and him crucified. Now, the next point I would make as we try to understand what he's saying here is, if we ask ourselves, Jesus Christ and him crucified, is that a simple, unsophisticated, uncomplicated, untheological sort of message? And I would say, no, not at all. And in fact, just look at Paul's letters. I mean, look at the richness of what he talks about as he explores and defends the idea that Jesus is the Christ and that he was crucified. Because that's just a shorthand. That's a way of expressing this whole set of ideas. Jesus is the Christ is part of the apostolic message. Well, what's involved with that? First of all, I mean, well, a million things are involved with that. God exists. Yahweh of the Old Testament is that God. He revealed himself to Israel through the prophets. God is good, but human beings are evil. God has promised to rescue Israel from the nations that have oppressed her. God has promised to restore the world, rescuing us from sin and death. God has promised to send a man who would rule over all creation for God, restoring creation, restoring mankind, making of human existence everything that God intends human existence to be. All of that is involved in the proclamation that Jesus is the Messiah, the Christ. Because, I mean, it has to have content. What does it mean, Jesus is the Christ? It means, go and read the whole Old Testament and get for yourself this rich picture of what God has been promising to do for Israel and the world. Jesus of Nazareth is that guy. That's what that proclamation means. Now, and him crucified. This is the part where Paul is saying, as an apostle, the Messiah is not what you expected. I know that in part, the picture is of a conquering hero who's going to cast out the evil, oppressive Gentile nations and rescue Israel from its troubles. And that's true enough. But that's only the beginning of the story. Because remember, God is going to judge the world. The biggest problem that we have is that we are guilty before God. And one day we're going to stand before Him as our judge. And if some way is not found for God to be merciful to us, we will get what we deserved, and it's not going to be pretty. The Christ, the Messiah, came to be an offering for our guilt and sin. He conquered our guilt. He conquered death and condemnation by offering Himself as an offering to God. This broken, defeated man who was crucified on a cross and died this humiliating death is your Savior. Why? Because you needed to be saved from yourself more than you needed to be saved from the Romans. And then the crucifixion is not the end of the story. God raised Him from the dead after having killed Him. He raised Him from the dead to show that He indeed is this Savior and to show us that death has been conquered and that we will follow Him in resurrection. The proclamation, Jesus Christ and Him crucified, is a theologically rich message which requires explaining and understanding the Old Testament. It requires explaining the message of Jesus, His purpose, what He did, what His life and death and resurrection accomplished in the world, and explaining the implications of that message for us now as we try to live out a life of faith. That's what it means to proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified. Paul spent his whole life talking about that message and never even began to reach the end of all of the depth of implications of that message and what it has to say. Paul is not denying the richness, complexity, and profundity of his message, or saying, I decided to leave all that stuff behind and just say, well, you know, Jesus Christ and Him crucified. What he's saying is that a message centered on Jesus Christ and Him crucified doesn't sell well, and he knows it. But nonetheless, that's the message that he proclaimed. He knows that he's not going to be acclaimed as the next great philosopher with that message, because it is offensive to both the Jews and the Greeks. And it is interesting, I think, that, you know, I would say if we were to look honestly at the role that Paul has played in the history of the world, that he is one of the most influential teachers and thinkers that there has ever been. But he has never gotten the credit for that, I think, that he deserves. At best, he's blamed for having messed up, you know, the simple message of peace and love that Jesus preached. Jesus was a cool guy, and then Paul had to come along with all of this justification stuff, and where'd all that stuff come from? Paul still doesn't get the reputation as being a profound and wise man, because we're all looking, the world around us at least, is looking for something else. We recognize wisdom by something else, and Paul has just never had it. Paul knows the world around doesn't see the power and sophistication and profundity of his message, and he never sought it. He knows that they don't see it that way, and he made no attempt to sell himself as what the world would call wise. Instead, he said, I did my job of proclaiming the rich but challenging message of the gospel. That's what I did. Now, I'm going to have to talk about this again later on as we move on in this passage, because there are some other things that people would point to that would say, oh no, see, Paul is saying that he limited himself here in a certain way. And I have pretty much come to believe at this point that that's not what he means by those things later on. So we'll have to talk about that. But I am arguing here that Paul's not saying, I decided not to talk about anything theologically complicated. I just made it really simple. That's not what he means. Okay. Then Paul talks about another aspect of how he spoke when he was with them. He says, and I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. which seems like a little strange thing to say at this point. Why is he saying that? I think it's like this. I think this is the point. He's saying, furthermore, I did not expect to win converts through the overwhelming power of my personality and the fact that I am such a strong, dynamic, with-it-together person. I'm the kind of guy who comes into town and everybody says, boy, he's impressive. What power, what strength, what a tower of strength he is. He's just mowing him down and he doesn't seem to be fazed by anything. This is the guy that you've got to take seriously. Paul seems to be suggesting, you know, actually, the job that I do is challenging for me. I was doing it in weakness and fear and trembling. I did not always feel up to the challenge. I was frightened and afraid sometimes. Remember in Acts, when Paul is in Corinth, in the middle of his stay, he has a vision where Jesus comes to him in a vision and says, do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in the city. It seems to me that at least part of the implication is that is this word of encouragement and I'm with you and don't be afraid but keep going suggests that Paul was afraid and that he needed this encouragement along the way. So I think what the reason that Paul's saying this here is I am also aware that I didn't win people over by the fact that I am such a tower of strength and together sort of person that everybody was just bowled over by what an amazing person I was. I know that my message is not attractive to the world around, and I also know that I as a messenger am not particularly attractive to the world. I mean, if you're judging by what sort of thing is going to win the crowd, what it is I have to say is not popular, and I'm not the most impressive guy in the world, and I know it. I think that's what he's getting at here. I know that how I conducted myself when I was there was not the sort of thing that was going to win me the reputation as being the strong man, philosopher, mow him down, untouched by his circumstances kind of guy that some people might follow and find attractive. So if it's not that my message is attractive to the world, and if it's not that myself as a messenger is attractive from worldly standards, then why should anybody listen to it at all? Why did I expect that anybody was going to listen to what I had to say? Why should you listen to what I have to say? Well, he says, my word and my preaching were not in the persuasiveness of wisdom, but in proof of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not be in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. Now let me say once again, we have to remember the issue that he's talking about here, because we can take this and run with it in the wrong way. My message was not in the persuasiveness of wisdom. The way we might use that phrase, we would think, oh, so Paul's saying, I didn't bother to defend or try to make persuasive the things I was saying. Sure, what I said was irrational, it didn't make sense, I had stupid arguments, I didn't even bother to argue for it, I just said it was true. That's not what he means. Remember what he's been talking about. This persuasiveness of wisdom, the issue that he's been talking about, is this thing that the Corinthians wanted from him. They wanted him to be a certain way. They wanted him to have a certain kind of dynamic message that people would really go for. And he's saying, that was not what I did. He's just restating what he's been saying all along here. What did he do? He had instead the proof, the demonstration of the Spirit and of power. What is that getting at? What does he mean here? This is what I understand him to be talking about right now. Let me read some passages to you that I think illustrate the kind of thing that we're talking about. In 2 Corinthians, where, as I've said before, the gloves are off and Paul is really going at it with his opponents in Corinth. I've read you this verse before. He says, in no respect was I inferior to the most eminent apostles, even though I am a nobody. The signs of a true apostle were performed among you with all perseverance by signs and wonders and miracles. So there he's saying, if you have any reason to question my message as to whether I in fact am a representative of Christ, you've seen, in fact, the power of God at work in my proclamation. You have seen the signs and wonders that have accompanied my message. In Romans 15, Paul says, "For I will not presume to speak of anything except what Christ has accomplished through me, resulting in the obedience of the Gentiles by word and deed, in the power of signs and wonders, in the power of the Spirit, so that from Jerusalem and round about, as far as Illyricum, I have fully preached the gospel of Christ." Paul sees himself as preaching the gospel of Christ, accompanied with the power of signs and wonders and the power of the Spirit. The power of God is at work in his proclamation. And one other passage that I think is significant in this way, in Hebrews chapter 2, it says, "After this message of salvation," he's talking about, "was at first spoken through the Lord," through Jesus when he was here, "it was confirmed to us by those who heard," that is the apostles. "It was confirmed to us by the apostles. God also bearing witness with them, both by signs and wonders and by various miracles and by gifts of the Holy Spirit according to his own will." A very, very clear passage that says that God was giving gifts of the Spirit and doing signs and wonders in order to testify, along with the testimony of the apostles, that this message of salvation was indeed true. Now, it's not just the signs and wonders. I mean, it has to be ultimately the integrity of the message as well. There are false prophets around, and you have to be careful not to listen to them. But Paul can say, check this out. Look in the scriptures. Is this not what the Old Testament has been pointing us to? Is this not what Jesus said? Did he not do miracles of healing? Did he not rise from the dead? And is my message not accompanied with the power of God to demonstrate that in fact God is with what I'm saying here? Why should you find my message persuasive? Not because I have told you an attractive message that the world would find wise. Not because I myself am a powerful, compelling figure. Not because I have convinced you that I am really smart and I figured all this stuff out by myself. But it should be persuasive because God has demonstrated that I am his messenger. I am a messenger of God. That's why you ought to listen to it. Okay, now I want to make a couple of comments about this. Paul stops here his discussion of what he did not do, and he's going to start talking about what is truly wise about his message. I did not seek that kind of wisdom. I did not seek to be accepted on that basis. He's about to turn his attention to a defense that, in fact, he is a preacher of wisdom. And that's where we'll talk next time. But before we leave what he says about what he doesn't do, I want to sort of draw a few conclusions from it. Paul has said that he did not seek to do this thing. He did not seek to have this persuasive words of wisdom, but instead he preached the gospel. He preached Jesus Christ and him crucified. What does this model mean for us? What is it that we should do in trying to follow him? It seems to me that what Paul is trying to avoid here, what he's saying that I did not set out to do, when you look at the whole picture, he's not saying, I sought to be irrational. I sought to be unsophisticated in my theology. He is not even saying that I sought to speak plainly with no rhetorical style, with no power in my words. Paul can be very sophisticated in his rhetoric and very beautiful in his language at times. He's not afraid of that. That's not what he's saying that he tried to stay away from. What he tried to stay away from was achieving success by telling people what they wanted to hear in the way they wanted to hear it. He recognized that I can be more popular if I do it the way the world would recognize as being attractive and profound. But I did not go there. That's the lesson of this for us. If we want to emulate Paul, that's the thing we need to think about. Because it seems to me that the real gospel message confronts us with a contrast and a choice. It confronts us with a contrast with the picture of reality that we have bought uncritically from the world around us. We get this idea that I need these things, and I am this sort of person, and this is what's valuable, and this is who I am, and so on. And yet we've been living a lie. There is a contrast between the reality of who God is and who we are versus the picture that we have bought in the world around us. God exists, sin is real, death is not the end, God will judge, Jesus offers mercy. All of those are truths that the world around us has really lost sight of. And so there's this contrast between the way things seem to be in this world and the way things really are. But also, at the heart of Christianity is a choice that each of us individually must make. Will I accept my diminished place in the universe if I give the center of the universe to God? Will I admit that I have been terribly wrong and that God would be right to condemn me? Will I repent, turning away from the foolishness of the way I have been living and follow the truth? Will I look at my life in the light of more than just the circumstances in which I find myself? Will I remember the promises of God and my hope for the future and what God's promises mean for where I'm living now? Will I trust God? And summing up, will I believe that Jesus is the Christ, my prophet, my priest, my king? And will I believe that he was crucified to rescue me from my deserved destruction and lead me into glory and life? That's at the heart of this message. That message is profoundly different than what we are inclined to think we need in this world and is attractive in this world. But there are lots of elements of Christianity that we can take and use to sell a more attractive message. Now, we don't know specifically what it is that would have been most attractive to the Greeks in Corinth. But we know something about the kind of things that in our own world, in our own culture, in our own lives, that we find to be wise, that we find to be compelling and attractive. Now, I want you to understand what I'm about to do. I am not about to knock a series of people that I'm going to refer to. I want to raise some issues for us to think about. Some of the people I'm going to refer to, I would be quite happy to knock them. And in fact, if you want to know, yes, thumbs down. But most of them here, that's not what I'm trying to say. But I want to show you the kind of choice that we face here. You can take elements of Christianity and preach a message that is practical and tells you how to find success in life. And the thing that came to my mind is back when I was a lot younger as a Christian, going to Bill Gothard's Basic Youth Conflicts. This was sold to us on, look, this guy has gone through the Bible and he's found all of the rules that tell you if you do this stuff, you will find fulfillment and success. You know, you youths out there, you have all these struggles and conflicts, but if you would live your life according to these rules, you will find peace, you will find success. This is the guidebook. This is the rule book. Well, I have a problem with Basic Youth Conflicts because I think he was not a good student of the Bible and the rules are not the rules that he spelled out. I just think they were wrong. But I'm not here to say Bill Gothard wasn't a Christian or anything like that, but what I am saying is notice how attractive. There were tons of people who have gone to those Basic Youth Conflict things over the years because of the allure of the idea that you can tell me what I'm supposed to do so that everything will work. All I'm saying is I'm not saying that it's necessarily true that all those people involved in Basic Youth Conflicts didn't believe the gospel or anything like that. But what I'm saying is, I could go away from that. I mean, I remember the kind of stuff that he said there. I could go away from that and never have been really confronted with the heart of the gospel, because it wasn't about that. It was about success. I mean, it was a spiritualized kind of success. He wasn't saying, do this and you'll be fabulously rich and you know, die and have 72 young virgins and all of that kind of stuff. But he was saying, if you follow these rules, you will find life to be working in various spiritual ways. It doesn't confront us with the contrast between the way the world looks at things and the way the gospel looks at things. And it doesn't confront us with the choice. Where am I investing my life? What do I think in the end is going to be the fulfillment of my life? For many people, wisdom would be the sort of thing that we find with political conservatism and family values. I mean, I'm not trying to sell you anything here, but I'll say in making my comments that I am a politically conservative person. Nonetheless, the fact is that political conservatism can be a very attractive message. Now, I want to mention focus on the family. I'm not knocking focus on the family, but I think we could talk about focus on the family and positive and negative aspects of what's happening there. But what I want to say is, think about it. That's very, very popular. Does that indict it, as I'm saying, as very popularity proves that it's straight from Satan? No, that's not what I'm saying. But it's very possible for something like that to gain a large following because, oh, I am very interested in knowing how should I raise my children, and I'm very worried about pornography and abortion and homosexuality and all those kinds of things. And I really do want to have somebody who can encourage me and help me to think about those things. Great. I mean, think about it. But you can talk about that stuff all day long and gain a large following and still not be talking about the contrast, the real contrast between a worldly way of thinking about life and the gospel. And that choice that I must make about who am I going to follow and what am I going to admit about myself as a sinner. Political liberalism can equally be an attractive message for many people. We can take the elements of Christianity, Jesus as the liberator, Jesus as the peacemaker, Jesus as the one who condemned the rich, and we can proclaim a message that many people will find attractive. But again, it doesn't confront me with that issue. Who do I think I am and who do I think God is? We can proclaim a message of power. I mean, we have people like Benny Hinn, you know, knocking them over like bowling pins. I mean, look at the power of God here, and look what I can do for you. If you were trying to guess who it is that I would say I'd be willing to knock, Benny Hinn would be one of those. That has nothing to do with Christianity. I don't know what that is. That's some weird thing, but it's not. I mean, I'm willing to take the rap for being a person who does not approve of what Benny Hinn does. Okay, and there are a lot of them that do that kind of thing. But it's attractive. There are tons of people who listen to this because power, yes, the power of God, that's what I want. Emotional satisfaction. We can take and put together a picture of Christianity that says, come and be a part of the church, join in the worship and fellowship, and you will find a warm bath in which to live. Now, there's nothing, again, there are aspects of that that are fine, but it's entirely possible that you can spend your whole life living in that warm bath and not ever confront the issue, who am I as a sinner, who is God, and what am I putting my hope in? I don't have experience with seeker-friendly churches myself, so I hesitate to knock them and say I know it's a bad thing. But I'm very suspicious about this idea. The idea is, what we do is we have a church where we don't talk about the hard stuff. We don't talk about sin and that kind of stuff at first. We have music, we have drama, we just talk about life's problems, and we get people coming so that they can kind of get interested and go, wow, these people are cool, they're interested in solving life's problems and so on. And then you kind of slip them over time the stuff about, well, Jesus, died on the cross and that kind of stuff. I mean, There, I'm not saying that seeker-friendly churches do not ever get around to talking about the cross. They do. But I can't help noticing that that's not the way Paul did it. Paul's whole deal was, what I did is I went for the jugular. I just went right out there and put it out there, Jesus Christ and Him crucified, bloody, hanging on a cross. That's the message that he proclaimed. And he said, I know a lot of people aren't going to like it, but that's what I talked about. Okay, so you put all this stuff together. I think what the point of all of this is, what Paul is urging, what Paul is saying he conducted himself by, is there is this central core of truths that we have to confront. That's what his job was to confront people with those truths. And if we decide for one reason or another that those truths need to be kind of covered over or prettied up or even maybe lightly set aside so that we can talk about stuff that people find more interesting in one way or another, we're going terribly wrong. That's the sort of thing that Paul is talking about. So like I said, I'm not saying that all those people I mentioned have gone terribly wrong necessarily, although I think there are problems in various places. But what I'm saying is, we need to recognize that the power and attractiveness of all of those messages, the fact that so many people find it attractive, doesn't mean necessarily that something spiritually significant is going on. Because the spiritually significant stuff happens when you confront the big questions about yourself and God. Okay. Another point I wanted to make is, I think it's very interesting what Paul says about his weakness, fear, and trembling. I think it's very encouraging to see this picture of Paul that he himself would say, I didn't get picked for this job because I myself am a dynamic figure who has no problems that people are going to be attracted to. What I have been given is understanding of the gospel. God has taught me and made me adequate to do this job. You ought to listen to me because God made me adequate to do it. I know what I'm talking about. You should listen to me. But that's why we ought to be listening to him, is because he was right. He proclaimed the truth. And the same thing, I think, ought to apply to us as we think about our own lives. In the first place, we need to warn ourselves and guard ourselves against the cult of personality. It is not the personal attractiveness of the person talking that is at stake. The issue is, are they proclaiming the truth? Now, we don't have any apostles around now, but so what the best we can do is ask the question, do I have good reason to think that the person I'm listening to has spoken accurately what Paul said, what Jesus said? Teachers that we know do not have any authority except the authority of the scriptures behind them. And the more I become convinced that they have spoken what the scriptures are saying, the more I need to listen to what they're saying. And it doesn't really matter whether they personally are compelling people. Now, does it matter whether they are people of faith? Yes. Does it matter whether I see the work of God bringing them to maturity and faith in their own life? Yes, that makes a difference. But does maturity and faith necessarily look like a person who does not fear and does not tremble and is not weak in the midst of it? I don't think so. Because Paul was very mature, and yet this was not always easy for him. And who has weaknesses and fears. I mean, I just do. And I comfort myself with the thought that I think every now and again I manage to get it right as to what it is the Bible is saying. And if so, that's a valuable thing. Now, come over to my house and watch me fall apart. I'll even do it for you here. I mean, but the fact is that I think there is something real behind what I'm saying and what many others that we could point to, not just in this group, are saying. There are people with problems. There are people with weaknesses. There are people who get in their own way sometimes, but they know something about the gospel, and that's why we listen to them. And one last comment I wanted to make. Paul talks here about the power of God in his teaching that was the vindication for his message. And I want us to think about that just for a minute. We've talked about this sort of thing before, I know, but we need to be clear in our minds what's going on. Remember that passage in Hebrews that I read. This is the message of the apostles, those who were given the task of speaking for Jesus, and the signs and wonders were given to authenticate. It was God testifying, yes, indeed, these guys are speaking for me. So what we know for certain from the Bible is that God testified to the reality of the authority of Paul and of Peter and the other apostles through the miracles that he was doing surrounding their ministry. And that's important in that God really is a God who is proclaiming something that is worth believing. He's saying there are reasons for believing this. I'm willing to show my power in this situation to demonstrate that these guys are with me and that you ought to listen to them. But at the same time, we in the modern day will find people who talk about power evangelism and that sort of thing, where they're saying, basically they would say to you, you know why you shouldn't be listening to Ron? Because there's no power in what he does. Where are the miracles? Have you seen God, Ron lay his hand on somebody and have him fall over? Or do people start speaking in tongues as he walks past? Or has he healed anybody or anything like that? Well, come over to our church. We got that stuff going on. And that's how you know that you ought to listen to us instead of him. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. I mean, that's really out there. So does Paul's picture here, is that supporting them in that view? And I would argue no. It could fit that sort of scenario, but in fact I think the picture is it is the apostolic message that is being authenticated through the miracles of God. He never claimed that from now on anybody who goes to try to explain and articulate what the apostles said, someone like me, is going to be accompanied by miraculous signs that vindicates their ministry. Because from my perspective, as I understand the Bible, as I've said before, it would be strange for God to vindicate my ministry, because the fact is, sometimes I'm wrong. I'm not an apostle. The reason you ought to listen to me is if I have made a good, compelling case for why we ought to understand Paul this way. That's why you should listen to me. So I don't want miracles telling you you ought to listen to me. I don't want that kind of authority because I don't deserve it. Nobody that you know deserves that kind of authority. But the miracles serve us in saying there were people who do deserve that authority. Paul deserves it. His story is compelling. I have a good reason to believe him, that he was the person that he was because of those miracles. Okay, I am going to take a few minutes for questions. We got started talking with this part a little late, so I'll take a few minutes, even though we've come to 11:30, but I'll probably cut it short. But if you do have any questions or comments, we can take a minute for that. Margaret, back there.
The humorist Dave Barry once said that if God is going to give us a message, he's not going to do it via a guy on cable TV with a bad haircut. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
I do believe that hairstyles are an indication of spiritual maturity, and that's probably all I need to say about that. No, I think that there is an intuition behind Dave Barry's humor there that is right, in that, it could be wrong too. I mean, because if we think about, if somebody said, so you're telling me that God is going to reveal his great truths through some guy who just wandered around wearing sandals and being dirty, and he had 12 followers and then they crucified him. Right. I mean, that's how God's going to do things. I mean, that sense that we know that how it is God is going to reveal himself, we need to be careful about that, we're not just imposing our own worldly values on that. But I think behind that observation is this sort of the sense that, you know, it does seem sort of implausible that the power of God, the God who is so concerned with the profound issues of what we believe and life and death and judgment and repentance and all of that, is busy at work, you know, giving people supernatural gold fillings over here or that kind of thing. That sort of sense that somehow this seems screwy. It doesn't seem... I mean, I'm willing to believe it. If God really is speaking through the guy with the bad haircut, okay, I need to listen. But it doesn't feel like it. It just doesn't seem to make sense. That, I'll buy that. I mean, that I operate that way.
So the main problem is not the bad haircut, but all the other accessories.
Right, right. I think if you want to see some wisdom in what he was saying, that's just a metaphor for a whole series of things that seem to not add up. And yeah, I admit to that being the case for me.
You made quite a bit of time to make the point of what would be the wrong reason to choose a gospel that would be because it was attractive, you know, successful or emotionally satisfied, I don't know, all the different ones, yeah. Spiritual healing.
Right.
And then you made the short point of confronting it. Could you make just short, I know it's hard to do this short, but elaborate a little bit more on what is attractive and what is somewhat unattractive,
right,
about the true attractiveness,
right,
of the gospel?
Right. Yes, I have been... Part of my problem is Paul doesn't go into any detail in 1 Corinthians about that, so I'm constantly sort of importing this in from other things that he says. But it all starts, I think, with the idea that all of us recognize we would like to find a solution to the problem of our existence. We recognize that there is a problem. And it is not wrong to want the solution to the problem of our existence. And in fact, the gospel offers the problem to the solution of our existence. And so in that sense, it is, if it's true, then it is profoundly important and desirable and attractive because it is the answer. But the reason it's not attractive is that it describes our problem in ways that sometimes we would rather think our problem is something else. Our problem is centered on the problem of us and what we're like. Our rebellion against the truth, our rebellion against God, the fact that we do not love God with all our heart, soul, and strength and love our neighbor as ourselves. We're not those kind of people. And life has gone sour because we're like that. And not only is life sour now, but it's going to end on the sourest note of all, in that God will judge us rightly as being rebels against what is good, as being corrupt, and throw us on the trash can of history. That's our real problem. The gospel, the good news, comes along and says, but you know what? There is a solution to that problem. Because God in Christ is bringing us mercy. And mercy means then that I am not under God's wrath. I am not under his anger as I would rightly be in this world. But I have been accepted by him. So that means right now, in all my weakness and folly and still continuing sin, even though I believe in him, I have been accepted totally. And God is committed absolutely to taking every single detail of my life and weaving it together in such a way that I arrive at goodness. I arrive at life. I will not be condemned. I will be freed from the thing that is staining my life now. I will find health and fulfillment and goodness and holiness and life evermore. And I am on the road to that. And furthermore, because of the activity of God now, I have the opportunity now to move from being foolish and, what's that, you know, like having blinders on, narrow focused, I lost the phrase, short-sighted, I guess is what I mean, that perspective where I have missed so much of what life is really about. I have the opportunity to actually grow into wisdom, to actually understand something of what's really going on. So I am growing in maturity and wisdom now, and I am arriving at life through the power of God. That's tremendous. That's everything. I mean, that's the whole deal. But the struggle that we have is, that can only be encouraging, that can only be attractive to me if I have really bought that I have that problem and that God is who He says He is. If I don't see God that way and I don't see myself that way, then the gospel is never going to be attractive to me. It might be attractive for a number of reasons, but sooner or later I'm going to face something that's going to make me decide, do I want this stuff that the world offers, or do I want this thing that God is doing?
You might get a little emotional satisfaction from that too, right?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, okay. And that's good. I want to emphasize in what I was saying, there's nothing wrong with really any of the things that I was describing if they have taken their place around the central truths that we have to confront. Emotional satisfaction is not a bad thing. And I think, I mean, the Bible describes ultimately the fruit of the Spirit, including things like joy. And I expect that. God is moving me in that direction. But you have to go through the door of confronting the hard realities in order to get to that joy, I think. So yeah, emotional satisfaction is not bad. It's just that we sell ourselves too cheaply. We go for the thing that will give us the immediate gratification in one way or another, and try to avoid those issues about, yeah, but do I need to repent? And am I seeing God for who He is? Am I grateful to God for the salvation He's bringing? Or have I got my eyes set on what I can get for myself now? I mean, those are the places. It's not wrong for us to want good things for ourselves, because God has promised to give good things to us. That's why the gospel is good news. What's wrong is for us to want good things for ourselves and thus push aside the truths that keep us from immediate gratification in order that we can get what we think are good things now. That's where the problem is. I think Paul was saying, that's why I'm not interested in the kind of message that people find immediately attractive and go, boy, that's what we really want, because it's not going to last. In the end, I may get them, but I'm going to lose them, because as soon as they figure out that there's more to this than what they bargained for, they're going to go away. We might as well make it clear what's at stake so that we know what it is we're wrestling with. Okay, I really do need to quit at this point. And we'll pick it up next time.